radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
I'm going to act as your moderator. My name is Pete Rizzo. I'm a retired captain out of the city of Rochester, New York. I'm with the New York State Task Force 2, the state USAR team, and also president of Tech Rescue Corp, which is a private training, technical rescue training company specializing in confined space, hangar rope, trench. We can be reached at techrescuecorp.com. And with that, I'm going to turn this over to our panel to do their introductions and bios. We can start with Chief LaFamina here.
My name is Fred LaFamina. I am a battalion chief in the city of New York, Rescue Operations Battalion. I supervise daily second-long fires, any tech rescue incidents, and I have the 5 rescues and the 7 squads under my command. I am also on the New York Task Force 1 Urban Search and Rescue Team. I'm a task force leader. I am also the operations chief on the White Incident Support Team for FEMA. That's basically it. Joe?
Thanks, Fred. Joe Bricado from Baltimore City Fire, the chief of training, special operations, and homeland security. 28 years on the job, 14 years of that as a captain of Rescue 1. I'm involved with USAR at the federal level as a member of Pennsylvania Task Force 1 and also task force leader with Maryland Task Force 2, which is our regional urban search and rescue task force. We have 1 heavy rescue and 4 squad companies and some specialty teams in our special operations command. So that's about it for me.
I'm Scott Murbach, a lieutenant with Baltimore City Fire Department. Serves as the executive officer of Special Operations Command, which oversees the rescue companies, all SOC assets, to include our technical rescue team and dive team. Also the program manager of our regional USAR team, which is Maryland Task Force 2. Serve as program manager and rescue manager for that component. I am also a member of Maryland Task Force 1, which is a federal team, and serve as a rescue specialist for them.
Hi, I'm Nikki Tomboy. I'm a lieutenant with the Squad 41 in the Bronx. 23 years on the job. 12 years I spent in Rescue 3 and the last 5 as lieutenant, special operations. Also a search team manager on New York Task Force 1.
All right, thank you, gentlemen. I think we're going to start out just by asking you to share any innovative programs or courses that you may be developing or heading toward in the technical rescue field, anything that you may have that is kind of looking toward the future, I guess.
Go ahead, Brendan, start.
What we're doing in New York City right now is we have a tech rescue school that's dedicated to Special Operations Command and some support units that we train at different levels of tech rescue. Some innovative things we're doing right now, we are running a lead climbing class. We've taken the mountain climbing realm and brought it into the rescue world. This gives us the ability to climb bridges, traverse. We've had some incidents, as I'm sure you've seen, with cable cars. At the Bronx Zoo, we had one a couple of weeks ago. We were able to mitigate it through the normal channels, but if we had to climb, we had to come up with some sort of device and some training. So right now we're in the midst of that training. It's lead climbing. We're giving the guys the ability to climb under bridges, over bridges, tower cranes. I took the class myself. It was pretty good. We continue to keep the tech rescue training going, including the recertifications. Those are very important. We now run annual education days to recertify the members in trench and confined space, which are kind of governed by the laws of the state, and you have to provide that training if you're not in the space. So we're doing that. We got a lot of other stuff going on, advanced firefighter removal. I'll let Mickey talk about that. That's kind of his baby. But that's the direction we're going in. We're trying to keep the special units special. Everybody wants to do our job. Are we willing to train everybody? Yes, we are. But we still need to be at the next level, because at the rescue level, there's nobody else coming. When you're there, you're the last line of defense. So we need to advance our techniques, and that's the direction we seem to be going in right now.
Yeah, I think to piggyback on what Fred's saying is that looking not so much at the innovative stuff coming up, and certainly the program they're talking about, that Fred's talking about, that they're doing New York is fantastic, as they've led the way in a lot of different areas when it comes to specialized rescues. But some of the challenges, I think, you know, looking at just trying to stay where we are and stay on top of our game is really critical. You know, as Fred was talking about, as more and more of these courses and these certifications and all this different training comes along, it's critical to try to keep up with the certifications, to keep up with the level of training, and to make sure that people are on top of their game, you know, in providing the best training out there with regards to the different certification levels. And as Fred said, we have the same issue that, you know, we get a lot of people that want to take the training, a lot of people that want to do the job, but at the end of the day, when you call those specialized units, that is your ace in the hole, and really there is nothing behind that, and nor should there be. I mean, I think that's your highest level of operational experience and training. But the challenge, it remains to, you know, with tightening budgets, and, you know, the further we get away from September 11th, 2001, the more difficult it becomes for those of us who aren't in this field to understand the need for it, to understand, you know, how we need to keep moving it forward, and it's always a struggle. We're working a lot with right now with RIT programs, even though that's really not in the realm of special operations. It is a training component and could be considered within the realm of that. So, as a matter of fact, before we began, we were talking with Fred and Mickey about looking at what they're doing in their program. But that's certainly an area where special operations can take the forefront, is with large area search, RED, firefighter rescue. A lot of those things that maybe we in the rescue community haven't really thought of as our responsibility, and certainly, you know, there's always that give and take with being a RIT unit on the fire ground. Nobody wants to do it, but everybody thinks it's important. So, you know, training people to do that, while not a special operations function, certainly falls within that. So, you know, I think that, you know, there are some innovative programs that these guys are working on, but I think the bigger piece to that is really trying to stay where we are and make sure that what we're doing is the best we can be. And that's really, you know, the focal point for a lot of what we do.
As the chief was mentioning there, we in New York City developed the advanced firefighter rescue program. We worked on it for over a year, and a big part of this program was that we looked at our recent past. And I say recent past, we went back and did a historical perspective on the 23rd Street fire, which was 1966. And we took from that point on, and all the fatal fires that we had, unfortunately we've had a lot, that we learned something from all the ones that we had. And what we did is we took all the senior guys in special operations, and we had them come in and sit down, and we all sat down in the committee, about eight of us, and we discussed the fires that we had, the difficulties that we had, the honest things that we learned from that. Like you said, it wasn't our successes. It was our
failures. Oh, you've been a minute.
Why couldn't we get a guy out of cell? Why couldn't we get a guy out of while we were a tenement? And what went wrong, and what could we learn of it? What we did, we took the companies for the first time, the chief, very supportive, and all the chiefs up to the ranks of the city, is we take five guys, the whole company. We take a company officer, five guys from each company. We take four companies that come to that, two squads, two rescue companies, come offline for a week, and then we put them through this program. And a lot of it is actually examining case studies, and then we actually were fortunate enough to get Baker Buildings on Fort Totten, where we took and replicated four different fatal fires and what we learned when we put the guys through. And everybody that's been through it so far, we're halfway through the program. Each company, to get everybody trained in special operations, takes us 12 weeks to get everybody through it. So we're in the middle of that right now, and everybody so far is great. And again, we do it under actual fire conditions as close as we can. No, we don't burn the buildings, we can't burn the buildings, but we're pretty innovative when we use the torpedo heaters. Salamanders, that every class so far we've lit at least one object on fire. So we go, what's that part? Can we grab them? But the thing is, it's so hot that if you don't, you know, we're down there, we have a stairway situation with one, and as a coat rack, because that was a very intricate part of it. Made it very difficult to remove a firefighter in Brooklyn. And people say a coat rack. Well, when I went back and looked at this coat rack, it wasn't an ordinary coat rack. Coat rack weighed 75 pounds. When you say 75 pounds, everybody here can pick up 75 pounds. But now when you operate in the stairway, the temperature was several hundred degrees, where if you came up off your hands and knees, you instantly burned. Front. And they had a firefighter trapped on the landing, and we use that as a case study. And you'd be amazing how difficult it is to move a 75-pound coat rack. And the heat that we replicated there is not even close to what they had that day. But they get pretty close. The guys that were there, the guys actually did the training. And it's pretty close. So that's a big thing. Like, it's not tech rescue, as we say here, but in New York City, rescue companies are formed to rescue firefighters. And that's our still our primary mission. All the tech rescue we've taken on over the year and everything else that we've dealt into, with, as the chief said, lead climbing was doing now, we're just getting into that field. But our basic thing is still, when a fireman is trapped in New York City, it's the rescue companies, squad companies that are called, and the harder guys are going to get it. And if it doesn't happen at that level, it's not going to happen. So we do train and we learn from our past history, and that's the whole thing, we learn from the past. And I just had a recent fire about 2 years ago where something happened there, and we bring it out in there, something that we never experienced before. So we take a hard, honest look at ourselves. What we learned, and we pass it on to all the others. So.
You know, we stress in New York State, what we call the four steps of rescue. Primary step being patient contact. And, you know, we see in like the rope classes and things where folks will start building anchors suitable for multi-person loads, things like that, where we want to get the patient contact. And then our disentanglement or disentrapment issues, like you were speaking of with the coat racks, our packaging and extrication. Lieutenant Murbach, I think you're up on this first round of what sort of innovative things do you see down in the future there?
As far as patient contact,
we
kind of stress this in our daily Special Operations Command. What we've done is when East New York did the rescue medic program, we're very well versed in the FEMA medical specialist class. So we basically adopted that curriculum and created a SOC medic class for our medical providers out there. First one we ran was last year, very successful. And nothing but positive feedback from the members taking the class. So we're looking to do that in the future as far as the medic portion. Now, I understand we should relay that information back to the daily rescuers as well, much like the federal system is doing in a lot of the larger programs. It's getting that rescue or medical awareness to your rescuers on a daily basis. So there are a few programs that we're looking at. I think New York does it, really, so we're going to look at them.
Yeah, you know, and when we looked at that whole program, you know, we kind of said, well, we've got four squad medics, we call them, or SOC medics. You know, we kind of looked at, do we need two more rescuers? What are the issues that we need in another a medical component? And, you know, we look at, you know, issues like cold water near drowning, you know, crush syndrome, compartment syndrome, tox medic, and those kind of things. And where we moved in that direction was training the medics to be able to provide the kind of specialized care that we're going to find in technical rescue situations, long-term rescue situations, you know, not only for the victim, but for the rescuer as well, hyperbaric medicine, things like that. So that's kind of one of the directions we're moving in on the medical side of it. And it's kind of a marriage between EMS and SOC to say, you know, there's a medical part of this. But rather than having two more people that are trained to utilize certain rescue tools, let's have them as the medical part of this, that they have the highest level of medical training as compared to the highest level of rescue training. So it's a kind of a marriage across those lines.
On that note, though, we have progressed to that rescue medic. Unlike most departments in the country, our EMS system is a bureau of the fire department operations. They're not firefighters. So we kind of took them in, we adopted them, and trained them to our standards. The danger you run, which they haven't there, is
what Joe's saying about training them to the medical level, be the best medical personnel you can be. We went the other way and trained them to be technical rescuers. And with that, there's a little too much, because what you now promote is a member of the department who doesn't do this on a daily basis, who has a little bit of training now and decides, well, I learned how to build a shore so I could work in this space. Not only medically, I am now trained at the technician level to operate in a confined space, out of collapse or void. And you run the danger of giving them too much training, and instead of what they did, which I would like to do, is focus more on the medical training, especially for the commanders. There's going to come a point. The firefighters are all competent. Some of them are EMTs and paramedics already. In New York City, they cannot operate at that level due to the laws of the state. But they can assess the victim. And as a commander, when you get that information, you go, okay, we need a medic in there. We need an IV. There's some type of syndrome. We need some specialized medical component. Get them into the space. Once their job is done, you pull them back out. Let the rescuers go back to work. So it is a great program, but you have to be careful, okay? You give somebody a lot of training, they're going to want a lot of equipment, they're going to put themselves in positions now they don't belong in, and they should really focus on their part of that incident, okay? That's just the risk you run, and I've gotten that from experience. And go ahead.
This is kind of a question that you can walk through. Conversely, are you training firefighters to the level of paramedics, or are you still very similar to New York?
No, all our firefighters that come in since 1996 are trained as ALS, EMTI. So everybody's ALS. Now, I could do a whole conference just on that issue.
Right.
Because, that's a whole nother story. But yeah, all our people are trained as EMTIs. So there's a lot of cross back and forth between the EMS side of the house and the fire side of the house. But I really agree with what Fred said about that program.
I know it's something of an industry buzzword, patient care, patient contact. I guess it's been found that when the rescuers do make patient contact, sometimes they sort of give up that strive to survive because they're in the rescuer's care. So that's an important issue, certainly. Gentlemen, with the recent crane collapses, bridge collapses, such as the one in Minnesota. Yes.
I want to mention one thing about
patient, convoy.
Yeah, patient contact. Mm-hmm. Two things. One, we had a recent fire, like I talked about, and one of the contributing factors to the firefighter's death was they call positional asphyxiation. And what it was, he was sitting there talking to us, laying in the brain, and talked the whole time. In the last 10 minutes, he went unconscious. What it was is that he wasn't exchanging his blood there. We're working now with our medical director to come up with a way that they can use a capnography monitor. And we're working on a way to integrate it into our face piece, that we can know that. We never picked up that day, and I talked to everybody that I could about it. Nobody ever knew about this before. It's a new situation. So we're looking to push it in that direction out of this advanced firefighter rescue program, too. That we'll never have to experience this again. But personally, it was very frustrating for me. I thought I was going to have a couple of talks with this guy. He got the hospital done. So we are going to learn from this. The other side is, too, two recent experience we had in New York City also with fire patient care. Again, it was our own that was in trouble. You all remember back in 2005, Black Sunday in New York City, we had six firefighters jump out a window. One of the firefighters broke his neck on impact. One of the firefighters that went to the scene was a paramedic on the side, knew right away, recognized the condition that this firefighter was suffering a possible broken neck. Took the time. Again, what do we do as firefighters? We all want to help. What do we do when we see a brother down? Grab him, scoop him, go on, get him out of there. He realized his firefighter was in great condition, and all he did was properly package him. Collar, backboard, properly packaged him, got him out into the medics and into the hospital. The surgeon said, and they had to do a cervical laparotomy on the way ahead, something like this. But the surgeon told them they had not packaged him properly. He was unwatched. Just 6 months ago, or thereabout, I had a firefighter fall out of the bucket in the South Park. Fell 25 feet, landed on his back. Again, he broke C1. Brothers wanted to grab him and throw him into the spoke. Again, when we stop, let's package them right, slow down, let's do this right, get them in there. And it was just by that few extra seconds, and that's what it all takes, guys. We all know that. Package that firefighter properly, he's coming back on the job. And the surgeon told him, too. If they've thrown you in the scope like they wanted to without packaging, you're going to want to do it. So take the time. When we see one of our own in trouble, that's the time, you know, special operations, the most important thing is saving a life. A firefighter's life is nothing more important. It was a simple, basic thing. It wasn't something advanced, effective. I tell you guys all the time in the class. It's the basics, guys. You can't forget the basics when a situation like that. So that's two recent incidents in New York that we all learned from. There was a big plus.
Surely. Thank you. Getting back to the, I would classify them as the low-frequency, high-risk types of situations. Now, historically, fire service has been somewhat reactive in these incidents rather than proactive. What could you recommend for not just the larger departments, but maybe the smaller departments also, to prepare for some of these incidents? You know, when they make the call to 911, we're going to respond no matter what the situation may be. So as far as department capabilities, budgetary constraints, training time schedules, what might be some recommendations that you would have that would assist us to better respond and accomplish our missions?
I'll start with that.
Chief LaFamina.
It would have to be organization is the first thing. Your incident command system, no matter how small your department is, how big your department is,
it all starts with organization. You have to know your resources, the level of training of your resources, what's available, where it's coming from, how much is coming. Those are all things you could be proactive in and get all that stuff documented. And then when the incident comes, at least you're organized. If you don't have a component of a tech rescue team, you have to know where it's coming from. You have to also recognize the level of training of your local jurisdiction. You may get to the incident and it's now overwhelming. It's too big. We can't do this. We have to stop and say sometimes, you know what? We can't do this. There are jobs we can't do. We're not trained to that level to be able to operate safely, okay, and legally sometimes to get the job done. So I think a big part of it is organization. If you have good organization, good incident command skills, I think that will enhance you when the actual incident actually occurs in your jurisdiction. Good commanders, when they're overwhelmed, will recognize this and then anticipate and then hand off to somebody with more expertise or at least a support system that they can use. Mm-hmm. That's the way I look at it.
Thanks, Chief.
Yeah, I agree with Fred on that. I think that if you're in a smaller department especially, you know, you've got to look at making kind of a needs assessment. You know, what are your areas of most frequency, even if it's low frequency, high risk, you know, kind of saying, well, what are the areas that are most frequent in specialized rescue? Is it, you know, vehicle extrication? Do you have grain silos? Do you have farm machinery? You know, what is it you have? And then being able to document those cases, because if you're going to make a pitch to either your department heads or your city or county agencies or managers, you need to have some data to back that up. You know, it's all well and good that people like us say, well, you know, darn it, we need to have this because if it ever happens, we're going to do this and we're going to do that. People at the levels way above us don't look at it like that. They don't have that passion. They want to see statistical data. They want to see what it is that is going to bite them in the backside when something happens that they're not covered. And that's the best way to push a lot of this stuff through, is not with the passion of we're here to save lives, but to give them statistical data that says we have 200, you know, grain silos in our district. Over the last 10 years, we've had 50 whatevers, rescues, extrications, recoveries, and start to put some of that together so that you can present that. That's the part of the job that none of us really likes, but it's kind of being able to say, you know, here's what our biggest risks are based on the statistical data, and here's where we think we need to go. Come up with some short-term goals. You know, what do we want to do by next week? We want to buy or purchase this. Here's what it costs. Within 2 years, we want to provide this level of training. And then within 3 years, we want to be to this level and have a plan in place that can document, you know, where you were versus where you are and where you want to go. And also, you know, there's a tendency, I think, for all of us to want to say we want to have our own team and we want it to be at that level. And, you know, you can have a jurisdiction right next to you who wants to have their team to that level. Well, the problem with those resources is they're very difficult to come by, especially in smaller departments. And then you're faced with this situation where you're fighting sometimes for the same dollars, if maybe they're grant dollars or if it's a state level type of thing. So by partnering in a smaller department with your surrounding jurisdictions and say, look, we'll form a regional team. You guys will be more trained in this and we'll be more trained in that, but we'll work together. We'll handle cross details or whatever. And that way you're showing the people that, you know, you're trying to work to get the biggest bang for your buck. And, you know, you're really saying, you know, regionally, because they are low frequency, you know, it's better to have a small group of highly trained people than a large group of moderately or poorly trained people. So, you know, by pooling your resources together, sometimes, you know, like I said, especially in smaller departments, you can get more bang. And as Fred was saying, know where you're going to get it. If you don't have it, then it's your job to know where you're going to get it, because if that doesn't happen, then you're solely on your own with that. And you can't rely on an incident commander who's not special operations trained or doesn't have an understanding of it to know where those things are going to happen. So, you know, have a plan and also know where you're going to get the resources that you need if you don't have them. You know, we always go back to, you know, risk versus benefit, and, you know, do you need a water rescue team in Las Vegas or Nevada? No, but, you know, we all remember the video of the guy who got caught in his car in a flash flood in the desert. So, you know, things are going to happen, you know, but you're always, and don't give up. Don't give up. It's easy and it's frustrating because a lot of times, you know, we're fighting people that don't understand necessarily the mission or understand it, but don't, you know, when there's so many other things out there. So, you know, you have to keep pushing to accomplish what you want to accomplish.
Thank you, Chief. You know, you had mentioned grain silos. Now, it seems to me that that may fall under a federal mandate, being confined space, so maybe resources can be a little bit easier required regarding the federal mandate there. And when we're looking at these different areas of tech rescue, MVAs, machinery, elevator, aircraft, swift water, surf, swift water, or I'm sorry, that's twice, ice, low angle, high angle rope, trench, confined space, structure collapse, there's a few more in there. Lieutenant Murbach, do you see development of specialty teams? Let's say, well, you're from Baltimore here. Do you have specialty teams that are assigned those different types of duties rather than encompassing the whole umbrella?
Yes, we have a technical rescue team, which is called Special Rescue Operations Team. It's basically an 18-member team that's trained in the all the 1006 components, with the exception of dive. We have a separate dive team that just handles dive operations. We also have a regional urban search and rescue team that is more comprised of all the USAR components, plus we're looking to expand into the dive operations.
Lieutenant Conboy, up in your county, how do they handle some of those? Because I know that you're, where you live, you have swift water, ice rescue. Are those handled by separate departments that come together?
The problem is that do anything where I live in Orange County, New York.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a regional thing. And I think that's the answer for the even the smaller cities, is to have regionalized teams.
Right.
You know, there's two teams that are trained, and they respond in the region. They just had a recent visit with a market trap in a trench, and they called another team from another county, and they had a third team from surrounding county on standby. And then the state team is also a resource. But I think that's really where we're going is, everybody realizes with the limited money available out there, and that is more funding than grants available, but we're all competing for that same money. And
right.
If you're trying to split the pot 10 ways, well, are you really that effective? And it does take a lot of funding, and it takes a lot of training, one, to get up to that level, if you're going to accomplish all of those disciplines, and then to stay at that level. And I think that's what you see at the state and regional level. It's even tougher at that level.
It does seem that way with FEMA being, or formerly being somewhat air-based and regional teams now ground-based, FEMA responding within that 1,000-mile or so radius. It does seem like development of regional teams is coming of age. What about cross-training with different regional teams? Do you see that coming up in the horizon here, across some more cross-training, not only with EMS but with law enforcement? Another buzzword is the unified command. And how do you see that kind of you going toward the future?
Oh, you mean other people want to do our jobs?
That goes back to the first answer you gave, right, Fred?
That's where you're going with this.
I don't believe so, Chief.
I don't think that's another conference, Fred. Right?
Let's get down to nuts and bolts. Let's talk about just basic training. Company training. Yeah, a little sore here. Let me rub it out.
No, I'm good, man. I'm good.
For company training, how do you keep that fresh? How do you keep folks interested and motivated? Because we're talking, it's got to be 600-700 hours easily when you talk about a lot of these disciplines, and that's not even the technician level for some of those. What are your recommendations for keeping that fresh, keeping folks interested? Again, low-frequency responses.
Money's a good one.
Money's a good one.
You have to train. The bottom line is you have to train. See, we're very lucky. We're from big departments. Mm-hmm. I could walk into any one of my firehouses. They're training. I want to see something. They're training on it. It's easy. So they're so motivated. The important thing for the commanders to remember is they're trained to do something. Let them do it. Okay, don't get to the scene and say, well, I'm not too sure. No, I'm positive. I know my guys can do this. I know their capabilities. I know if I can't see inside the space, I'm sending Mickey in. I know he's going to tell me, Chief, this is what we can do or we can't do it. Trust your guys as long as you're comfortable with their training. So if you're not doing it every day, you still have to trust their training. You have to let them. I think that's the biggest motivational factor. If you're trained in something, you should be allowed to do it. If you show that you're competent in that skill, you get to the scene, you can't have one of these old, none of us here, ranking chiefs say, well, I never saw that orange rope, so you're not doing this. That's not the right answer. That's ignorance at the command level, that they're not keeping up to date with technology and training and the ways of the world. So I think that's a big motivational factor. Let them do their job. They know what they're doing. They're trained to do it. Let them get in there and do their job. If you're not doing it on a daily basis, a monthly basis, provide the best training you can in a semi-actual atmosphere, whatever you can do.
Yeah, and I think that's probably one of the biggest key things is make the training realistic. You know, I'm sure everybody in this room has been to a training session where, you know, it was simulate that and pretend this. Now say you did this. Now, we're not going to do this, but if you were to do this, you know, setting up the training and setting it up to be realistic motivates your people. Is it difficult? Sure, absolutely. And you know, these guys will tell you that's the hardest part, and that's what takes all the energy, is finding what you need to and putting it all together to make the training realistic. What Mickey was talking about before, doing case studies. So that you're saying, you know, this is based on this. So when you go in and you provide that training and you're telling somebody this is based on an incident we had 5 years ago, that person correlates that to something real world. That actually happened. So I know that this can happen again. And motivate your people by making it realistic. As Fred was saying, let them do it. Trust them that, you know, if you've trained them, then you've got to let them go to work. And whatever experiences you learn out of that will be a learning experience for them and for you. And so you constantly be moving forward, but looking at everything in the training realm to say, you know, if we operated on this incident and your decision that you made was questionable, let's talk about it. Let's figure it out. Let's see what went wrong so we can make it better for the future. And I think continuing to build your people, you know, those of us, not at this table again, you're right, the older guys, you know, we're kind of at the point in our career where we need to be looking to the younger people and bringing them up, mentoring them, building them, so that as we continue moving this whole specialized rescue realm forward, you know, we're actually filling in the bottom too with our next generation of leaders and the people that are going to take over when we move on. So it's not so much where we are and, you know, but who's going to take us to where we want to be down the road. So those were my thoughts.
Thanks, Chief. I know Mickey Conboy isn't aware of it probably, but he actually inspired me as an instructor when I asked him what kind of motivates him as an instructor. His answer was, speaking of age, at our age, we feel a duty to kind of pass it on, more or less, you know.
So I think probably he impressed you so much that you dyed your hair, grew a mustache.
That's a fact, yeah.
I'm looking at the two of you. I'm thinking, yeah.
Well, you know, it's a New York thing, I guess.
Yeah.
That's a fact.
That's right. A lot of heat down here.
Yeah. Bada bing, bada boom.
Lieutenant Murbach, what about just basic company training and motivational factors? Keep the troops.
Yeah, it's definitely like the chief said. It's having the funding there. I know there's the motivational factor of yes, you can give us a little incentive of doing that training. We have not reached that level here yet in Baltimore. We're still working on it. Now, I know New York, you guys have got a pretty good raise for your SOC guys, which is definitely a motivation.
Yeah, specialty pay. He's talking about we have specialty pay now in special operations.
15% or something like one at a top.
It's only 12.
You taking any applications up there, Fred?
No. That's always a motivation for members. Yes, there does come some times where the older guys do get burned out from doing the training over and over for, you know, 15, 20 years or something. So you just got to have to try to mentor the younger guys to have that replacement as needed as they come up in the ranks.
Mm. All right. Mickey?
A big thing, I think, is the recruitment. You know, in line with that specialty pay, we just got in New York City, which we never asked for, we never even thought we would ever get. But a big thing is recruitment, I think. And there's three big things that come, you know, we just got a new captain in the company asking, Mick, what do you look for? You know, we bring these guys in here all the time, we're going to start up with these guys. What do you really look for? What do we want to weed out? What are we looking for, keying in on when we interview these guys? Because in New York City, you go to the squad wrestling, you've got to get an interview. Go there. And I told them the biggest thing is right off the bat is attitude. It's a cap. It's a small thing that means everything. The individual's attitude. They come in here with a shit attitude, we check them off the list right now. We have a long list and a short list. On the long list, there's 50 guys on a long list. There's 5 guys on a short list. 5 guys on the short list are the guys that you're really looking to bring over to recruit in the company. So attitude is a big thing. The next thing is motivation. Like you say, how do we motivate them? I told them right off the bat is self-motivation. Look for the guy that's self-motivated. Who is the guy that has a past, has shown us in his past? When you ask him, like, hey, guys, said, what have they done, you know, in the past, everything like that. We just brought a young guy to the company recently where his military past, this guy was a Marine recon sniper. He had everything that there was in the past. Highly motivated, highly skilled guy. And I said, we'll teach him everything he needs to know here. What he's going to do is raise the bar with everybody else. And he did. He's a highly motivated guy. Everybody loves the guy. The guy's what we want. He's a hard charger. All I got to say is go with a guy like that. It's not a matter of telling him what to do. It's a matter of pulling the reins back when I don't want him to charge. He's a thoroughbred. He's built to run. I got to hold him back when he don't want him to run. But the other thing is, too, is experience. What did they bring to the table before they get there? We can train everybody, but the thing is, do they have a background in the trade? And that was a big thing for the years we used to get, and we're starting to get it again. But military, we lost for years there in New York City, we lost military experience. Now we're getting it back. We have an abundance of guys after 9/11. We have no shortage of guys with military experience. And that's a big thing. So those three things, attitude, self-motivation, and the experience of the individual before they get there. When we get those guys that have all three of those, we got a solid individual, and they all come with that background. So I think that's a big thing with the special ops.
Thanks. Yeah, I know on career side, when I was on the rescue, I would kind of start my training really over the coffee table, cooking the meal, discuss what we're going to do for training, maybe the following shift. On the volunteer side, as we were breaking out equipment, doing equipment checks, we discuss exactly what we want to do, be it an abandoned subway bed where we're doing torches and concrete breaching, or a high angle and suburban terrain. We kind of get those things accomplished, and just it would be a natural progression. Actually, I picked it up from Captain Hatton, bless his soul. to get some of those things accomplished. All right, we're going to take a short break in a second, but let me ask if there is any questions out there, anything we've been discussing so far. Any questions for the folks? No? Yes?
I have one.
Yes, sir.
Dealing with specialized rescue vehicles as it pertains to vehicle electrification and trucks and whatnot, what are you folks doing with the increase in accidents, segregations, and with the car technology changing the way it is? What are you folks doing as far as training as well as the equipment?
Mickey, you want to start up?
I'll defer to Chief. But
okay.
I think like that.
We have a class. We actually have an extra. See, that's the one thing we're privileged to have in New York City. We have money, equipment, and training. We have a dedicated unit for extrication that give all the units that have extrication tools the training. Keeping up with new technology. The other thing we do in special operations, we have to take it to another level. We do what they call, was it heavy, big rig advanced extrication, where they're actually bringing in fire trucks, dump trucks, buses, more advanced stuff on stabilizing the vehicle, different access points, you know, where to cut, how to cut. So the thing really, if you're not privileged to that all that money and training, you have to keep up to date on the new technology on your own, and it's changing every day. I see something on a vehicle now, every day there's something new.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're not as developed as FDNY in that regard, but, you know, we through the academy, which, you know, having being the chief of the academy and special operations, it's kind of melded together, but through the academy, we can take advantage of kind of getting information from, you know, the car manufacturers and the different people out there that we then push out to special operations through Scott and through the, you know, through email. Email's a great thing. You know, you can put something together as a training bulletin and push it out to all your specialized units about things that are up and coming and what to look for. And then following up, in your training scenarios. I mean, this all comes back to training. 90% of special operations is training for that 10% that you're actually, you know, going to use it. And then, you know, you got to be on top of your game for that. So I would say that if you don't have as developed a system like FDNY does, that, you know, you're going to have to take it, as Fred was saying, you're going to have to take it upon yourself to do that research or develop those connections with the people that are going to provide you that research. Sometimes it's the tool manufacturers, Hamatro, Hurst, people like that, that will push some of that stuff out as it's coming up. And then if you have a connection with them, they'll give you that information. You can package it, use it in your training scenarios, or send it out in an email blast or a bulletin, and, you know, make sure your people are reading it, discussing it at company training, around the kitchen table, if nothing else. But, you know, we're all saying the same thing, that it is going to be changing, and it's changing all the time with, you know, the type of, and that's the other thing, is we always train on older cars because that's what's in the junkyard. The problem is the newer cars are going to be the ones you're going to deal with. So whenever you have that opportunity to work on a new car, I say go for it. So always remember, it's about the patient care. So if you have the ability to take the roof off, you know, then go ahead and take the roof off. The car can be replaced. And we had a job one time, I don't know if you were with me, that we had a vehicle, big woman in the back, huge woman in the back seat. Couldn't get her out. The car had like 300 miles on it. Well, when I was at the rescue, we ended up taking the roof off because we couldn't, you know, that was the easiest way to get the person in the back out. Probably the driver would have just as much cut her up and taken her out in sections than have the roof cut off. But, you know, the idea is, you know, always if you're out on an extrication with a newer type vehicle, there's damage already done, take a look at it, and if you need to, you know, work with it right out there on the scene. But, you know, those are some of the creative ways to try to work with the newer technology.
One note, I was talking to Ron Moore this morning. He's like an extrication guru. When I do have questions, I email him. He gets right back to me. He's really good source of information. You see something or read about something, he already knows about it. So he's another guy you could tap into.
There's a lot of sources of information, like Ron's articles, things like that. That you're keep that can help you to keep abreast of that stuff. But the main thing you got to remember is push it out and share it with your people.
These trade shows are great too. You can go right around yourself, everybody here, and look at all the new tools. But we did it in the city just last year. We invited all the manufacturers of the in to look at all their latest. Cool. So we were comparing apples to apples, not apples to oranges. So some guys, we got to get a market, we got to get this one, we got to get that one. It's not that we were neighboring, but when we put each of the manufacturers on the floor down there today, out there, their best tool up against another best tool. We were comparing apples to apples, guess what? We were comparable, I'll tell you that right now. The other thing is, too, get the tool by the car manufacturers. We just had a Mercedes come in last year, and they donated those cars. Now, we had a big problem because some of the members that were going to cut these cars were going to steal it.
Right. Including myself.
Yeah. And go to a junkyard and get an old Mercedes.
I don't want to steal it. I just want to use it.
Yeah. For 5 or 10 years, right?
Right?
Yeah.
Let's go get Julio across the street and not let him cut over it. But the serious thing was what we thought was going to be difficult on some of those old cars because of what we read wasn't. And then other things, other techniques that we thought were going to be standard. That wasn't so difficult, very difficult. So, really, what you have to do is get out there and train them like that. Somehow get to the manufacturers, get new cars. But you're going to have to do it on a regional basis. New York City, we can make phone calls and the company can come there. But you're going to have to do it. And even there, the problem is we have to limit how many people can come. So, like we did it, the guys said, how do you know about that? Well, they only have so many guys because we only have so many, whatever can happen with that. The thing is, we try to disseminate it through the rescue school to all the companies if there is something new out there. But we just went through a whole thing, but it just did all the rescue for them, right? They outfitted all the new tools and the rescue companies in New York with Hurst. We're Hurst, that's it. But their tool compared to anybody else's in the world. So that's it. Just get out there and ask them if there's something new. And like that, Ron was a great resource. But that's the thing to really get out there. But there's things that I thought were very difficult for them to talk about.
You know, and I guess
the thing I opened it was that we did the fire truck. You really want to see a difficult operation, try to get a fire truck. Not spread it, cut it. We have to cut it. Like you want to try to get a roof off the fire truck. Some of them were very, very good. We actually broke when we cut it first cut on the fire. So that can be a very daunting task with one of our own scraps on the truck. We unfortunately experienced that where it was a difficult operation.
A lot of the manufacturer safety divisions, such as Ford, Chrysler, whatever they may be, they would actually send you bulletins if you call them. Just if they come out with new techniques and safety concerns, they can issue bulletins out to you. So there's like a listserv email that you can sign up to get that information as well.
A lot of people on the internet too. I know Toyota has a whole website that they have all about their hybrid cars and everything like that. So it's a great resource on the web.
I know, too, if you find a rescue company-friendly salvage yard owner, they'll prep the cars, they'll stack them up any way you want them to, which is a great asset also. And I know FDNY's got the Pass It On program, which is basically a citywide newsletter on unusual incidents that happen, and that's through fax, or is that an email?
No, it's a
paper.
It comes out in a department bag, like the mail.
Right. Okay, so that's another program that's been fairly successful for the unusual things that happen. Things that you talk about in the morning with your company, with your group, that you did last night, only it's citywide. So, anybody else before the break? We'll take a short break. Okay, let's take five and see you here shortly.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
All right, everybody's nicely refreshed, I can see. We're going to just close this out, a couple other areas of discussion. I'd like to get your comments or views on what levels of certifications you feel teams should achieve, and also the question regarding recertifications, refresher training, and things of that nature. Any success stories or also roadblocks that you've come across? Regarding those things,
I'll go first.
Okay,
I'm going to use the national training gauge. I'll discuss something on that within the USAR system, which kind of sets the standard for these teams. Everybody wants to copy them, which is good. It keeps everybody on the same page.
they look position specific. If a guy is a planning chief, does he really need to be a technician at technician level for structural collapse? He probably doesn't, but he does need awareness training. So when the guys are asking him for, you know, the logistics guys are telling him we're going to use this equipment and we're going to do this. This is our operation for the day. He needs to understand that. Keeping that training up to the standard is tough, and that's an individual thing or a team thing. The problem with a lot of this is I'm on one of these groups. Mickey's on one. We go twice a year. It changes the first meeting, the second meeting. It goes back the third time to the first meeting, and then the fourth time we finally decide. So it's very dynamic. It changes a lot. That's the challenge, to keep the standard at one level for the individual position and then work from there. And that's what I think you need to do. Company level thing is completely different. I'm sure Joe's going to give you some insight on that.
Yeah, I'd like to let Scott talk about the certifications. I can fill it in with some of the overall stuff.
What we do in the city, we strive for the technician level, 10-06, for all our SOC companies. We have four squads and a heavy rescue in the city, and that's what we do. Every Thursday we conduct, not only we conduct battalion training, which the company does on a daily basis, like the chief said, how they do it with their company drills, but every Thursday we set a date to where our SOC companies come out for the full day, and we do a certain discipline, and that meets our recertification process in the 1006 standard. But yes, all our SOC companies, we strive to have technician level in that, and then operations and awareness down to the regular department. What we found out with a lot of the SOC companies is the commitment and their level of motivation, like Mickey mentioned earlier, on going that extra mile to get the certifications. We do offer the technician courses throughout the year. We found we're getting half and half guys from within SOC and throughout the other department. So the motivation level is, that's where we're looking at as far as recruitment as well. These guys that are stepping up and wanting to take the classes, these are the people we're looking at putting into the SOC company. So it's definitely challenging with recertification and the definitely discipline training.
Yeah, one of the things that you know, and I'm talking to a couple of guys here during break, you know, the challenges we have, and one of the reasons we have this forum is, you know, you got special ops, and then you got, you know, like everything else. So for us, we don't have a problem buying in. In my years in the job, I've gotten to have a lot of friends in FDNY, in Philly, in Boston, in D.C., in the rescue companies and in SOC. And people would say to me, you know, why do you interact? How come you're so close with these guys? And I said, you don't understand. It's a mission. It's a mindset. I have more in common with these guys than I do with a lot of people in my own department. So, you know, how do you get people to buy in not from our level, but above, to buy into what it is you're trying to do, whether it's trying to get a certain piece of equipment or have the ability to interview people like you need to do, or to get the funding that you need to get, or whatever. And you know, you have to be the cheerleader out there. You have to be the guy that's constantly enlightening the non-special ops people and get them, bring them over, talk to them, show them what you're doing, so that when you do need to go back for your training levels and you do need to go for funding, you know, people have somewhat of an understanding of what it is you're trying to do. It's always a challenge trying to keep the funding levels, the training levels to the certification that you need to do. And the good part about that is there are now standards and laws that will help us if people are really serious about doing it the right way, and say, you know, it's 1006, 1670, OSHA standards, this and that, OSHA laws, that will help us say it needs to be to this level and we need to keep it there. The problem is a lot of times, you know, it becomes, as we were talking at the break, a matter of justification and a matter of liability, and that's what sometimes people at the financial level or the political level understand, and that's all they understand, you know, is making sure that we can document our training levels and making sure we can show that there's training that needs to be done to a certain level.
Question.
Question for whomever. With the 1006, are you folks, saying your folks have to get certified and bring it back, and then your departments, are you certifying them to 1006? Are you bringing an agency in? You said they're certified.
In Maryland, we're pretty lucky. We have MFRI, the Maryland Fire Rescue Institute, and that's all our training is conducted through them as far as the certification courses. So, yes, we are an accredited training agency in Baltimore City, so we're able to conduct that class. So, we do that for our own members.
In New York, we are fortunate. We have all of our courses accredited through the state. And Brian Russo with the state, they are right to the NFPA national standard, and all our accreditation comes through the state. So that's how we do it in New York City.
But it's something to look at in your individual department, or if you're the military, you know, it's something to look at as do you need to bring somebody in, or can you get an accreditation, or are you accredited, or somehow or another, whatever agency or department you're working for, you know, what are those options open to you?
I think it also, in order to be a little bit less reactive and a bit more proactive, and I know your program at noon, Chief Afamina, is going to discuss resource typing and accreditations. I know we had an experience, a couple of them, where regional response teams came together in a location for a flood, and the question became, what level can you respond to this particular incident? So what do you see as far as resource typing? Are you seeing that as something in the near future, or do you see that as something that's currently taking place for our audience here that's won't be at the noon?
Yes, I mean,
there.
I'll take that. Yeah, you
sure.
Definitely see the resource typing issue coming alive. You can just look at Katrina and see what happened there. You know, I mean, water rescue assets were called, and you know, two guys in the pickup of the canoe in the back was your water rescue element. So, yes, the resource typing is definitely a need out there, and here in the state of Maryland, we're pushing that. We've had a change recently in our emergency management agency, and they're definitely aware of the problem that we've had. What we've done in Maryland is everybody was able to type themselves. So a document will go out to you. Okay, what do you have? Do you have anything on this list? Well, what a rescue asset. Okay, maybe a John boat or something. But there's really no policing of the system as well. So what our state is looking at is, yes, coming out with the typing document with NIMS, and then having a policing committee, so to speak, to go ahead and say you have this, you better have it in case I call for it. So that's what we're doing here in Maryland.
And doing audits and actually seeing what's going on.
Yeah, I think that's one of the big things with resource typing is, you know, how do you get your resources into that database or whatever it is you're putting them in? And secondly, as Scott was saying, is how accurate is it? You know, do you have a kid sitting in a computer somewhere answering for his department that says, you know, yeah, we have, you know, whatever, and it's not really accurate. So as Fred was saying, the audit and the follow-up is really just as important as getting the initial information. So it's a big thing, but I think with resource typing, again, it's a management tool. And as we look at our ability to fund these types of assets, our ability to deploy them, you know, because as we were saying at the break, you know, nobody wants any of this stuff until they need it, and then they want to know how long it's going to take to get there. So, you know, 90% of the time, they're going to push it to the side for that 10% of the time that you better be on top of your game. So the resource typing will help us in the broader management perspective of being able to know what we have, know how to get it, and make sure it's the right thing. But that's an ongoing thing. But that is a hot topic right now.
And I think it would assist in the reduction of self-deployment by unqualified teams where rescuers potentially become victims and things of that nature. Well, thank you, gentlemen. I'm going to open the floor for any questions you may have had for our program here, and we're going to wrap this up shortly after that. So do you have anything that you'd like to ask our panel here? It's a negative. Okay. Well, gentlemen, thank you. I'm going to close this personally on a personal note. As a New York State advocate for the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, I'd like to ask you to, if you haven't already visited the website, check out our website and check out the 16 initiatives that they've created. And you can simply engage in several of those initiatives right now today. Think about your families and friends. Wear the seatbelt. You've heard it a thousand times. We've discussed this at length. Take a look at your driving habits and how they affect you psychologically, how you respond. And lastly, try and develop a heart-healthy lifestyle. Okay, 50% of line of duties are cardiac-related. And I'll leave you with that. I'd like to thank you all for attending this podcast. Be safe, and God bless.
Thanks, Pete. Thank you.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.